Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to carry out full force strikes against Hezbollah.
We must finish with this problem with the Hezbollah.
The politics of Ukraine.
My support for the people of Ukraine is unwavering.
I believe I will be able to make a deal between President Putin and President Zelensky quite quickly.
And building an entire hotel with a 3D printer.
I've never been able to build with such little constraint and such fluidity.
Today is Friday, September 27th.
And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strobe.
The Prime Minister's directed the IDF to continue fighting with full force, according to the plan presented by the IDF.
That's an Israeli spokesperson saying Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to carry out full force strikes against Hezbollah until it ceases firing rockets across the border, dimming hopes for a ceasefire proposal. Those are air raid sirens triggered in Tel Aviv on Friday, just after midnight Tel Aviv time, 2140 UTC. In the last few days, Hezbollah has fired hundreds of missiles at targets in Israel, although Israel's aerial defense system ensured the damage has been limited. Israel rejected global calls on Thursday for a ceasefire with Hezbollah, defying its biggest ally in Washington and pressing ahead with strikes that have killed hundreds in Lebanon and heightened fears of an all-out regional war. At the White House, National Security Spokesman John Kirby.
We still believe an all-out war is not the best way to get people back in their homes.
Kirby said senior U.S. negotiators are still working with the Israelis and other partners to try to bring about a temporary ceasefire.
We wouldn't have worked on that statement the way we did. We wouldn't have issued it when and how we did if it wasn't supported by the conversations that we are having with top Israeli officials yesterday, and those conversations continue today.
U.S. President Joe Biden and other world leaders called for a 21-day pause in the fighting on Wednesday night. On the ground in Israel, there are many people opposed to that ceasefire.
This is bullshit because when you let them 21 days, they will arrange again. They will bring new missiles.
Not now, no. Cities have been completely ruined.
We must finish with this. To kill them, to stop them, to do something. But not this, not stop the war.
Israel and Hezbollah have been exchanging fire for about a year now, since Hezbollah launched an initial barrage the day after fighters from the Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas attacked communities in southern Israel on October 7th.
Vice President Kamala Harris said calls for Ukraine to cede territory to Russia were dangerous and unacceptable as she met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Thursday.
As I have made clear on our six previous meetings and throughout Putin's brutal aggression and war against Ukraine, my support for the people of Ukraine is unwavering.
Harris made a veiled reference to former President Donald Trump, who Wednesday said Zelensky wouldn't make a deal to end the war.
There are some in my country who would instead force Ukraine to give up large parts of its sovereign territory, who would demand that Ukraine accept neutrality and would require Ukraine to forego security relationships with other nations. These proposals are the same of those of Putin. And let us be clear, they are not proposals for peace. Instead, they are proposals for surrender, which is dangerous and unacceptable.
Zelensky emphasized the urgent need to bolster Ukraine's air defenses, stating it would save thousands of lives and reduce Russian terror to zero.
We have to end this war. We need a just peace, and we must protect our people Ukrainian families, Ukrainian children, and everyone from Putin civil. And we are grateful to America for supporting Ukraine.
Trump has agreed to meet with Zelensky on Friday. Here he is talking about the Ukraine situation on Thursday in New York.
I believe I will be able to make a deal between President Putin and President Zelensky quite quickly. I hate to see the carnage. If I were president, it never would have happened. Russia would have never attacked Ukraine. Never, ever. But Putin told me often, it's the apple of his eye. But I said, Vladimir, don't even think about doing it. He would have never done it.
It is unusual for an international issue to be central to the U.S. presidential campaign. So let's dig into how this is playing out in the U.S. and on the world stage. Joining us now is Robert David English, an expert on the politics of Russia and an associate professor at the University of Southern California. So thanks so much for joining us to talk about this.
Quite welcome. I'm happy to do so.
So it caught my eye. There's two different messages coming out of the two different political campaigns in the United States. Harris saying that seceding of any land to Russia is unthinkable, and Trump saying there has to be a deal. He's meeting with Zelensky on Friday. She met with him on Thursday. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I don't recall a time when a foreign policy issue was injected into a U.S. presidential election in such an intimate and stark way. I mean, of course, in recent memory, we had the Iraq war, the Iraq invasion, which went so bad, and George W. Bush was up for re-election, but there was no contingent for arguing to put more troops in, that it's a success. There was no split. It was just a matter of how to deal and overcome this mistake or this disaster. Here we have something different because we have starkly opposite positions. Keep supporting Zelensky and the Ukrainians and, in fact, give them more and longer-range weapons versus start winding this thing down and come to the table quickly and negotiate a deal. Starkly different. And it's in the middle. It's in the final month of a presidential campaign. And it's not a peripheral issue. It is a central one, as we saw in the debate and as we're seeing now with Zelensky in Washington. It is remarkable. And it's kind of volatile and unpredictable in its impact.
It's very un-American for us to look beyond the borders.
That's true. This one is different, and for the reasons we all know, because of the brutality of the war. Vice President Harris made it clear another reason why it's so intimate when she made this direct appeal to Ukrainian and Polish American voters in her debate, and tried to humiliate Trump as a weakling, and he would put their countries at risk too, right? And of course, for his part, Zelensky's in Washington right now, right? This coincides, our final sprint to the ballot box coincides with the UN General Assembly and all the world's leaders here. And Zelensky is meeting with everyone he can. And then there was that trip to the military, the munitions factory in Pennsylvania, right? A critical state. So it's got politics, presidential politics all over it. It's, as I said, volatile.
Which, by the way, Pennsylvania has a huge Russian and Ukrainian population. And you're not wrong, Polish as well.
Yeah.
Is it the America first narrative or, I mean, the Republican Party has become oddly pro-Russian and America first at the same time. How does that? I can't still reconcile that. How does that happen? What is happening there?
You know, I don't think the Republican Party knows what it is, and it has all these different constituencies, and it's only because of the outsized figure and the outsized influence of Donald Trump that we have this strong sort of pro-Putin kind of current going. I think a lot of the House Republicans are just going along with Trump. And if it weren't for him, they would be, more moderate, more traditional Republicans. You have this amazing split. You have a Speaker of the House, Republican, criticizing and violently, angrily criticizing Zelensky for having, you know, taken this trip, for injecting himself into presidential politics. But then you have the Senate Republicans, represented by Lindsey Graham, on the complete other side, attacking Biden for being too weak on Russia because he won't give them more and longer range weapons and permission to use them deep inside Russia. So who is the Republican Party here? And I think that there is, between the strongly, let's say, anti-Putin, anti-Russian, that would be, again, Lindsey Graham and the House, the Senate Republicans, and then between the soft on Putin, soft on Russia, maybe isolationist, you know, the Mike Johnson and the House Republicans, we have this broad middle that's just tired of war and probably fairly ignorant about the stakes, about the players. It's a faraway place, you know, of people we don't even know, kind of echoing Munich. And they're just tired of war. And let's face it, they have a lot. This is the blue collar, the kind of MAGA base in part. And they're not sophisticated in foreign affairs, but they do probably have a lot more sons and daughters serving in the military. And after all those years of Afghanistan and Iraq, I think this is as much just flat out anti-war as it is anti-Ukraine or pro-Russia. So look at all the current swirling around for different reasons.
How does this play with Putin and his advisors? I mean, I assume this is exactly what they want.
Yeah, they cannot be unhappy to see not just the strength of Trump and that position, but also, I mean, I suppose that 2 months ago with the Democratic Convention, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz looked like they were just going to get more and more popular. They were turning the table. So, yeah, the view from Moscow certainly has to be, well, we might get our guy back again anyway, Donald Trump. But they're also looking at Europe. And we've noted over the last month, just the last month, whether it was in Germany, whether it was the Chancellor of Germany, whether more recently the President of the Czech Republic, and a lot of others essentially saying out loud what many have been saying quietly, that there's not going to be a big reversal and huge victory over Russia. Even if we were to give Zelensky these missiles, this authority to strike deeply, we gave them the F-16s. They're not making much difference. We gave them this. It's not that they're giving up on Ukraine. It's that they're looking at the battlefield and saying it's not going to make a big difference. And yeah, they have domestic politics too. I've been doing my own research, polling, surveying opinion in Central Europe, in the Visegrad countries, right? Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland. And it has turned even more sharply than in the U.S. against the war. They still despise Russia. They're still afraid of Putin. They're still, you know, very sympathetic to Ukraine. But the economic drain on them is tremendous. And it's becoming a real problem for centrist Czech, Slovak, again, Polish politicians. Hmm. The Poles have their issues with the Ukrainians and grain. They all have a large number of Ukrainian refugees they have to support. And everyone is suffering from this, the cost of this war and the lost trade, the high energy prices. I hate to say it, no one wants to say this out loud, but Putin was right in part in thinking that maybe he can outlast the West. The backlash among, you know, the domestic constituencies, ordinary voters saying this has gone on long enough. My taxes are too high. I can't afford my heating bill. Another winter is coming. I can't even fill the tank of my car. Food prices are too high. They don't want Russia to win. They don't want to see appeasement or a deal that rewards Putin. But they're approaching the limits of their tolerance, and even centrist, pro-European, pro-Ukrainian politicians are now wavering. I think that's what Putin is seeing just as much as the confusion over here.
Sure. Thanks so much for the time and the insight. Professor Robert David English at the University of Southern California.
We're following these other stories from around the world. In the Trump election trial, special counsel Jack Smith has filed under seal a legal brief that prosecutors have said would contain sensitive and new evidence in the case charging Trump with plotting to overturn the 2020 election he lost.
The Argentine government says the official poverty rate in Argentina jumped to about 53% during the first 6 months of Javier Milei's presidency. That's up from 42%.
Denmark's King Frederik has laid a foundation stone to launch the reconstruction of Copenhagen's iconic old stock exchange, which was partly destroyed by a fire in April that toppled its green copper roof and iconic dragon tail spire. Frederik on Thursday made the first step toward reconstructing the building, which opened in 1624 to its former glory.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, candidate Donald Trump has been the target of two assassination attempts during this campaign. VOA spoke with some gun owners who say the shootings have not changed their views on gun laws. VOA's Veronica Valdez Iglesias has our story.
Keep walking!
Law enforcement prevent an assassination attempt against former President Donald Trump, detaining a suspect with a rifle at a Florida golf course earlier this month. That follows a separate shooter wounding Trump at a Pennsylvania campaign rally in July. VOA asked gun owners how the attempted assassinations affect their views on gun control in this election. Matthew Gonzalez says he was shocked by Trump's shooting, but that all Americans have the right to protect themselves.
Any bad person can get a hand on a gun. It's very, very accessible. You just got to know a couple people, and it's not hard. It's that people make it out to be. And it's always going to happen. That's why you have to just watch out for yourself.
Gun rights advocate Nick Clark told VOA the assassination attempts reaffirm how firearms protect regular citizens as well as the president.
The Secret Service is armed, and the Secret Service, who protects the president, saw the person or saw the gun pointed through a line of shrubs. You don't have to have every single person carrying a gun, but if you had more people carrying a gun for self-defense, these criminals would think twice.
But most Americans say it's too easy to get a gun in this country and favor stricter gun laws, according to the Pew Research Center. Every 11 minutes, somebody dies from gun violence in the United States, notes Milwaukee-based gun violence prevention researcher Mallory O'Brien.
Young people, 1 to 17, leading cause of death for them is firearms. We right now have the highest level of gun suicides that we've ever had in our country.
She says more thorough background checks and other measures could help. But Wisconsin indoor shooting range co-owner Cheryl Repholz favors enforcing existing gun laws instead of imposing new ones.
You can see the display of firearms behind me, and they're inanimate objects. They're just sitting there resting. Gun owners, we don't use them for felonies. We are responsible gun owners.
Authorities say the weapon used in Trump's first assassination attempt appears to have been purchased legally. The second suspect appeared in court this week, charged with possession of a firearm as a convicted felon and possession of a firearm with an obliterated serial number. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Mequon, Wisconsin.
A congressional task force investigating the attempted assassinations of former President Trump held its first hearing on Thursday, where they discussed lapses in communication and perceived missteps in preparation by the Secret Service during and ahead of Trump's rallies in Butler, Pennsylvania. Here is Patrick Sullivan, a former U.S. Secret Service agent, in an exchange with Republican Representative David Joyce.
All we had to know, if we knew there was a suspicious person out there, and this, I think once you listen to this today, you're going to find out, why in the world would you let former President Trump go out onto that platform if you weren't sure it was secure? That's the whole purpose of why the Secret Service was there.
Well, I didn't do the advance, and I don't want to say yes to
people
there.
I know, but I'm asking you, since you're here on their behalf, I'm asking,
Mr. Joyce,
you would have let the person come out?
Mr. Joyce, I would have taken the steps necessary. If I thought there was still a gap in the security posture, I would have taken the steps necessary, or I would have told the supervisors it's not safe to bring the president here. That's what I would have done.
At a rally on June 13th, Trump was shot in the ear. A rally attendee was killed, and two others were wounded in the shooting. The suspected shooter was 20-year-old Thomas Crooks, who was shot dead by a Secret Service agent after opening fire.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. According to the International Energy Agency, the world now invests almost twice as much in clean energy as it does in fossil fuels. But with that shift comes environmental risks related to the mining of critical minerals. VOA's Jessica Stone looks at how nations are navigating the environmental challenges of creating a renewable future.
This week, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a global pact to phase out fossil fuels and triple renewable energy capacity by 2030.
Renewable prices are plummeting, rollout is accelerating, and lives are being transformed by affordable, accessible, clean energy.
In Serbia, mining company Rio Tinto has discovered a lithium deposit expected to produce enough of the metal annually to build 1.1 million electric vehicles, according to Serbian media reports. Jeffrey Piot, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Energy Resources, says the project is a chance to grow Europe's green economy and wean the world off dependence on China's critical minerals dominance.
We're going to need a lot more battery minerals, but we're also going to need the batteries. We're going to need the cells. We're going to need the auto manufacturer.
But while the critical mineral demand is creating new opportunities, climate activists say it's also posing new environmental risks. The group Climate Rights International says a nickel mine in Indonesia is threatening dozens of animal and bird species through deforestation and pollution. Krista Shenham is a researcher at Climate Rights International.
As, you know, an environmental organization, we believe that EVs are an important part of the energy transition, but the way that this is being done in Indonesia is not necessarily part of a climate solution.
The search for solutions has driven mining companies underwater, where U.S. tech startup Impossible Metals aims to harvest nodules, or aggregates of minerals, on the sea floor of an area of the Pacific Ocean known as the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. Oliver Gunasekra is the CEO.
Unlike mining on land, there's no cutting or blasting or tunneling. You know, these rocks just live on the seabed floor. So literally you just have to pick them up.
Another U.S. startup, Viridian Biometals, replaces energy-intensive processes such as smelting with bacteria that can separate metal ore from the rock around it. But opponents argue there is no safe way to mine the sea floor and support a moratorium until the risks to deep sea biodiversity are better understood. It's a debate that's increasing, along with investment in renewables across the globe. Jessica Stone, VOA News.
And finally,
it's a crazy way to build.
In the U.S. state of Texas, they're using a 3D printer to build an entire hotel.
3D printing gives you a lot more room to experiment into, or even if you're sort of like quite confident, to do more organic forms.
That's Jason Ballard. He's the CEO of ICOM. They're building the hotel.
This printer has now been running for like something like 36 hours straight. And it allows us to print, you know, overnight. Last night it was like 55 degrees, and today I think the high will be 85. And so the material behaves differently in different humidity and different temperature and different levels of irradiance. And so actually we're like adjusting the ingredients in the mixture in the formula ever so slightly about every 15 minutes so that we can continue printing.
Liz Lambert is with El Cosmico.
I think that it's fair to say we will be the first 3D printed hotel in the world.
And using the printer, you're not confined to making square walls.
I mean, most hotels are contained within four walls, and a lot of times you are building the same unit over and over and over again. I've never been able to build with such little constraint and such fluidity, and just the curves and the domes and the parabolas, it's a crazy way to build.
They say it'll take roughly 6 months to print the 61 hospitality and residential units.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, alongside Alexis Strobe, I'm Scott Walterman.